I have a couple of things that I want to tell you before I share the presentation. One of them is this. I don't consider myself a scholar very much, but I have done some study that is, you know, it's not a story. It's not really funny or anything like that. It's just some real good information. And so I think that if you're into that, you'll enjoy this immensely. Otherwise, you may sleep some, but it'll be fun, I think. Anyway, we'll talk about it. Another one is what I'm going to do this afternoon is rather unusual. And I want to give a little disclaimer about this. And that is the reason that I prepared the material was to determine for myself whether or not our traditional Adventist interpretation of Revelation 13, the last three verses, is still valid or whether we need to change our position or not. And I'm going to tell you why I did it and where I've given this before so that you can get a little perspective. Kathy and I were in Norway last year for an appointment, and some of the brethren came to us and they said, "What is happening in North America at Andrews University? And are we throwing aside our traditional interpretations?" And I didn't know what they were talking about, and so the brethren there had a two-disc DVD set that had been produced by former Andrews University scholar Dr. Bakioki. And I have a good deal of respect for this gentleman, and I have, you know, I've heard him speak before and so on, and read a number of his books. But he was suggesting in the DVD set, which I purchased for myself and watched the whole thing, 2-hour program, three times, and he also has the PowerPoint program on there. And some of you are familiar with PowerPoint, and if you want to, you can write your notes on the bottom of it. And I printed off all the notes, which is about 70 pages of notes, and read and studied those as well. My conclusion was that it was time for somebody to re-examine the traditional Adventist position and see if what we had believed is correct. And I've concluded that it is. I'll just tell you ahead of time. But the more interesting thing about it is Ellen White herself did not talk about the 666 or Vicarius Filii Dei, although a number of our scholars, Uriah Smith, J.N. Andrews, and others wrote about it, and she never criticized them, so it was kind of what you would call a tacit approval. But I'm just going to tell you that there's only a couple of statements, about three statements from Ellen White that I will show you this afternoon. But this is going to take some fast talking and some quick listening, and I hope that we can get through it in the time that's appropriate. And I would also say that the reason that it's kind of unprecedented is I want you to understand that I'm not being critical of the other author. I'm only saying, from my perspective, this is what I found. Does that sound okay for you guys? So we'll do that and hopefully find something that's valuable for us. I'm going to give you, first of all, about 10 minutes or 15 minutes of basic prophecy so that we will understand the two beasts of Revelation 13. It is a very common practice now to call the two beasts the sea beast and the land beast. You've heard that before. But the fact is, some of our scholars, when they write about it, never identify them at all, which is unusual to me, to read a whole chapter written about Revelation 13 and never see the beast identified. But we're going to this afternoon. The four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. I mentioned to someone who's a guest at our campgrounds this week that prophecy, from my perspective, all of it is on the platform of Daniel 2. That, to me, is very, very basic. And in Daniel 2, God gave Nebuchadnezzar a vision, and he forgot the vision promptly. And you remember he asked his wise men to tell him what he had dreamed and so on. To make the long story short, Daniel was called, and he was able to, by praying to God Almighty, get not only the dream but also its interpretation, which is very, very difficult to do. I will tell you that. It is only by God's grace that Daniel was able to do that. Kathy and I have been married for 40 years, and occasionally she'll say, "I bet you never guessed what I dreamed last night." And we're like two peas in a pod, and I've never guessed at one time. So I can just tell you that it's supernatural that he was able to figure this out. But you have the four metals, you know, and by the way, I hope you understand that understanding that the four metals, you know, the gold and the silver and the brass and the iron, that represent Babylon, Medo Persia, Greece, and Rome, this is not an Adventist interpretation. Everybody should understand this is basic Christianity. We have old books at the GC Library. They have them at every library I've ever been to, but it's called the, not just a country library, but, you know, a seminary or something. But there's a set of volumes called the Antonicene Fathers, and it's like a big encyclopedia set. And the Antonicene means before the Council of Nicaea, 325 A.D. So essentially from the time of the disciples up until 325 A.D., it is the history of the Christian church. And the Antonicene Fathers understood Daniel 2 to interpret Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. So, I mean, these are the first generation after the disciples. It was known by them at that time. So all we're doing is building on that. But that's the basic platform. So when you see these four beasts in Daniel 7, which was given by God to Daniel himself, you're really not seeing anything else except a different depiction of Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. All Daniel 7 does is add a unique characteristic, and you know what that is, the little horn. So we'll look at that real quickly, and I'd like for you to see this. Now, I know you're not going to be able to read this, and I don't intend for you to do that. The only other time I presented this, I was asked by the Voice of Prophecy, and It Is Written, and the Pacific Union to present this to all of our pastors and evangelists at Simi Valley in December. So this is the first time it's actually been prepared or presented to a lay audience. But I actually had these as handouts. You know, I gave everyone a copy so they could look at it. But there's basically two kinds of predictive prophecy in the Old Testament. This is prepared by Dr. Richard Davidson of Andrews University. There's general classical prophecy like you would see in Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and so on. And then there's apocalyptic prophecy, which you see in Daniel and Revelation. And the apocalyptic prophecy typically has a primary focus on the universal sweep of history. And it also has visions and the ideas of symbolism, you know, like the metals and the beasts and that kind of thing. There's one other thing that I'll just show you real quickly, and I know you can't read this, but there are prophecies of Daniel, and there are major schools of interpretation. The historicist position is the typical position of the early church and the Reformation, and the one that is used primarily by Seventh-day Adventists. All of you understand that. The one, and this one, of course, has the year-day principle, and the Antichrist is the papacy, and you have Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome, and the divided kingdom, and so on. The most amazing thing, though, is that you also have preterist and futurist positions, and this one's no year-day principle, and the Antichrist is past, and in the other one, the Antichrist is future. So, you know, it's just a different way of looking at things. But I just wanted you to know that we understand that. Now, if you were to order Dr. Bakayoki's material, this is his title slide, The Mark and the Number of the Beast. Now, I feel comfortable using this because I bought it. You understand? I'm not just took it off the internet or anything. And what he gave this seminar, and he also had these two gentlemen, John Pauline and Ranko Stevanovic, who came and gave encouragement there. But I thought this was an interesting slide. He had this one. And I'm sure he didn't contact these two people, but and their faces are out there in the public domain, but you have Doug Batchelor and Lonnie Malashenko here, and he says, our evangelists are striving for greater accuracy. Some of them have asked me to verify the actual use of the Pope's title, Vicarius Filii Dei. And so he's doing the research. Now, here's something that's going to be very interesting to you. This is all of the slides that are in all color like this are actual slides from Bakayoki's PowerPoint program. But he says 666 is a human imperfection. Being one short of seven, the number of perfection, 666 may symbolize mankind that falls short of perfection. 666 functions as the symbol of the greatest imperfection. Now, that was his explanation. As you know, I subscribe to Roman Catholic publications, and I noted in this one, and this is September 24, 2006, so just a few months ago, our Sunday Visitor, I showed you a copy yesterday, had the whole front cover titled Decoding Revelation. So inside, they had a section on the numbers, And I want you just to see this part right here. 666 is extreme imperfection. The number 6 falls short of 7, the perfect number, and is thus imperfect. Since to repeat something 3 times functions as a superlative, 666 stands for extreme imperfection. Now, I want you to see this because I think it's important. I just talked about it a little ago, that Babylon, Medo, Persia, Greece, and Rome are equivalent there. And then Daniel saw it. These numbers, you know, the dates, you guys are all familiar with that. We won't spend time on it because I want to really get into the meat of the study. But they're equivalent. That's what I'm talking to you about. You understand that they're equivalent to each other. And, of course, the leopard of Daniel 7 is equivalent to the brass. And then the nondescript beast, the legs of iron, and so on. And then the division, it would be like the 10 horns of that unusual beast. But while he was looking at the horns, behold, there came up another among them, or another little horn. Now, I'm going to show you, these are the 3 verses that we're going to look at this afternoon. So if you want to, you can just write down, it's Revelation 13, 16 to 18. And I'm going to read it. This is from the New King James Version. And he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or their foreheads, that no man might buy or sell except the one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. Now, I said that wrong, didn't I? Because the number is not 666. When you look at it in the Greek, it is 666, or 666. Do you understand? It is not 6-6-6 in any Greek study that you would do. It is always 666 or 666. So it is a total number, not, you know, bad, bad, bad kind of thing. But we're going to look at it. So the methodology for interpreting the number 666, here's what I wanted to do. First of all, review Revelation 13, which we just did. Determine who the beasts are in Revelation 13. Determine whether gematria or a symbolic application should be made to the number 666. Now, gematria is something very interesting, and that means that you have numbers that are equivalent to the letters. Do you understand? Like Roman numerals mean certain things. Dr. Bakayoki concludes that gematria was not used in the time of John the Revelator, and since it wasn't used in those days, readers of the document, the Book of Revelation, could not have possibly figured this out. Do you see what I'm saying? The fact is, though, we now know that gematria was very common in those days, and I'm going to show you that, and I'll tell you just a little bit of what I found about it. Another one is to determine whether or not Vicarius Filii Dei is a legitimate papal title. And another one, applied gematria to the Vicarius Filii Dei, and then finally draw conclusions for a proper biblical understanding. I want to tell you something really interesting. It's just a life experience for me. When I was in college at Southern a number of years ago, everybody had to take Greek who was going to be a minister. That was kind of the thing that got everybody out or in, one or the other. At any rate, when I took the first year of Greek, I enjoyed it and did quite well with it, so I took a second year. And my teacher was Gerhard Hazel, who's the late father of Michael Hazel, who teaches now at Southern. At any rate, Gerhard Hazel was a very good teacher and a very interesting. If somebody can make something that's kind of boring fun, you know they're a good teacher. At any rate, I ended up taking 3 years of Greek, and then I took also archaeology from him, and I went to Andrews University and took Hebrew. But I have criticized the seminary and our colleges on the floor of the GC during annual council because of this. In the 35-plus years since I took those classes, I have used my ancient languages occasionally. But I didn't learn anything about money management at either place, and you need to do that every day and every week and every month. You understand? But when I did this research, thank God I still had all my Greek books and my big lexicons and all those things, and I was able to do some Greek study. And I'm not going to bore you with that too much, except to show you a few words and what they mean here. So we're going to look here. First of all, we're going to do the little horn. And I've got to do this really quickly, so I'm hoping that we can just go very quickly. We want to determine the little horn of Daniel 7 for a purpose. And that is, review the clues given by the angel for a positive identification. Location, it arose out of the fourth beast, came up among the 10 horns, etc. Did the papal Rome originate out of the Roman Empire? Well, obviously the answer is yes. I mean, I put it there. I believe it is. The time of the rise, it appeared after the other ten horns, that is, after the breakup of the Roman Empire, and so on. Did it come in that 5th century? Yes. Nature of the little horn, it was different or diverse from the other horns. And though it was little at first, it became greater than his fellows. You'll have the Bible references in there so you can see. Was the papal Rome different than the other kingdoms that emerged from the Roman Empire? Very obviously. Rise to power, it put down three kings or plucked them up by the roots. Three of the kings that emerged from the or kingdoms from the ashes of Rome were Arian in their religious thinking. These were the Heruli, the Vandals, the Ostrogoths. They were, with the aid of the Eastern Empire, defeated by Rome to allow for a more dominant control. So were these three kingdoms destroyed as papal Rome was coming to power? And the answer is yes. Attitude toward God. Now, based on what I told you earlier in this seminar, you know, the change of the law, and we talked about Thomas Aquinas' Summa Theologica, Volume 3, where, you know, way back in the Middle Ages, they said the church changed the day. It was part of the Ten Commandments, but the church changed. And the Augsburg Confession and also the Council of Trent, those things. Well, here we are, attitude toward God. The little horn would speak great things against the Most High, and so on. Another one, attitude toward God's people and the persecution. I think that it would be really interesting to understand history attests that millions were put to death under this religio-political system. I mean, anybody who understands history understands that. I mean, there's no the Inquisition, the whole business. Then the attitude toward God's law. This is what I was telling you about the change. The little horn would attempt or think to change times and laws. It would view God's laws needing changes and would attempt to make changes in that law by its own authority. And obviously, papal Rome did do that. There's more, the length of time for it permitted to rule. Most of you understand the 1260 days, but it was to rule for a time and times and half a time. This is verse 25 of Daniel 7. Again, this is not complicated. The time is 1 year or 360 days in prophecy. Two times would be 2 years, 720 years, half a time, half a year, 180 days. If you add them all together, you get 1260. And this harmonizes, of course, with Revelation 3:5, where this period is spoken of as 42 months, and 42 times 30 days per month in the prophecy would be 1260 days. Also in Revelation 12:6, where the time is actually recorded as 1260 days. So by the way, since this all speaks of the same thing, it works and meshes together, as you can understand. Now, we want to look just really quickly at Revelation 13. And I know I'm going very rapidly, but this is material that most of you already have in your computer and your mind. So 13 of Revelation, it rises out of a composite beast with characteristics of a leopard, a bear, and a lion. Now, where did we ever hear of those before? Daniel 7, exactly. By the way, they're in a reverse order that they appear in Daniel 7. Why would that be? He's looking back on them. They've already happened. Okay, the beast has seven heads and ten horns with crowns on the horns, a blasphemous name on his head. He has a throne and great authority, received a deadly wound and lived. The whole world marveled and followed the beast with worldwide influence. The beast receives worship, speaks great things and blasphemies, dominates for a period of 42 months, and makes war or persecutes the saints. Now, there are actually more signs or clues that we could talk about, but these should be sufficient to see a direct parallel with Daniel 7 and the little horn in Revelation 13. Does everybody, you get a little clue that that's the case? Therefore, this sea beast power, like the little horn, represents the papacy. Now, I have a statement here that I'm going to show you from Great Controversy, page 349. Now, this is kind of interesting. I really pray that God would give me grace to talk about this properly, but I will just tell you this. There are people today who say that Ellen White, with only a third grade education, was limited in her knowledge of history and those kinds of things, and she did not consider herself an authority on prophecy and so on, and that her work should be for just devotional reading. That's very common right now. But what I want you to understand is something interesting. She made explicit statements in Great Controversy that I believe are true because they line up with the Scriptures, as we talked about. So I'm going to read this. In Revelation chapter 13, verses 3 to 10, is described another beast, we call it the leopard-like beast, to which the dragon gave his power and his seat and his great authority. This symbol, as most Protestants have believed, represents the papacy, which succeeded to the power and seat and authority once held by the ancient Roman Empire. Of the leopard-like beast that is declared, there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and he opened his mouth and blasphemed against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwelt in heaven. And it was given him over the kindreds and tongues and nations. Now look at the part I've underlined, if you can see it. This prophecy, which is nearly identical with the description of the little horn of Daniel 7, unquestionably points to the papacy. If Ellen White is wrong about that, you pitch out the spirit of prophecy. Do you understand? This is important. Okay, now the second beast of Revelation 13 is the one that rises out of the earth. He had two horns like a lamb, and he spoke as a dragon, Revelation 13:11. Again, the biblical clues give unmistakable evidence of this beast with the horns like a lamb. It arises about the time when the first beast, the papacy, is wounded. It, unlike the first beast of Revelation 13 and the beasts of Daniel 7, comes up out of the earth and not the water. It has two horns like a lamb. It speaks like a dragon, and it has worldwide influence. As authority like the first beast, supports the first beast, encourages worship of the first beast, performs great signs, it becomes finally a persecuting power, and it causes many to receive the mark of the beast. Now, I'm going to go through this real quickly because I would hope that most of you would understand this to be the United States of America. But I'm just going to go really, by the way, if you don't know that, if you have the original edition or the current edition of Sunday's Coming, I did not change the appendix. And in the appendix, there's a chapter on Daniel 7 and Revelation 13, the United States in prophecy and the Antichrist revealed. Those two different chapters are two different chapters, and I think you'll find it to be really good evidence to unmask this as well. But the time of its power, we'd look to a country that's rising to power about 1798. That happened. Location of the new power, it was going to be a place where there wasn't peoples, tongues, and nations. All of the other nations came to power amidst the peoples of the earth by conquering them. Only one place was undeveloped on the earth at that time, like the rest of the world. Unlike the rest of the world, that was the North American continent. People came by the millions, and still today they want to come. Can be no question that is the United States also. Now this one is very important. It has two horns like a lamb. You should never, ever say it is a lamb-like beast. The Bible does not say that. It says its horns are like a lamb. Now, there was a gentleman a few years ago, I won't say his name, who talked a lot about Revelation, and he talked about the second beast as the lamb-like beast. And he says if it was like a lamb, but it wasn't the lamb, then it's Satan. And so you throw out United States. Do you understand? Now, the most interesting thing, though, is that it's never called a lamb-like beast. Only his horns are lamb-like. Some interpreters have called the beast lamb-like. But the Bible doesn't call the beast lamb-like. It says that its horns are lamb-like. Lamb-like describes the horns, not the beast. Ellen White makes 17 references in her writings to the horns, the lamb-like horns. She always says they are lamb-like, not the beast. There is a great difference in meaning. The beast grows to be big and powerful, but it has lamb-like horns. That's probably why some of our early illustrators illustrated the United States as a buffalo. You know, a big, powerful beast, but little, tiny horns. It's one of those big, curly guys you like to just run up and hug and pet them. They say, don't try it. You understand. I've only seen one or two domesticated buffalo in my life, and they've been in rodeos. I mean, they're so rare, you know. But the idea is, that may be why they pictured it that way. What do the two horns represent then? I believe they could quite logically represent the gentle characteristics of republicanism and Protestantism, a nation without a despotic king, and a church without an authoritarian pope. The bottom line here is that the new nation would have civil and religious liberty. Those are things. Now remember, what we're doing is identifying the two beasts of Revelation 13 so that we can see what the 666 applies to. It becomes very powerful. I don't need to go through that. Worldwide influence, exercise all the authority of the first beast, and so on. I'm going to show you probably just one other one. Encourages worship of the first beast, would perform signs in persecuting power. By the way, some of these things are so current, they're yet to be fulfilled, the last couple, in the transformed stage. It caused many to receive the mark of the beast. Look at this statement, Great Controversy 440. Ellen White makes this observation. What nation of the New World was in 1798 rising into power, giving promise of strength and greatness, and attracting the attention of the world? The application of the symbol admits of no question. One nation and only one meets the specifications of this prophecy. It points unmistakably to the United States of America. Now, this is not just implied, you understand. It's an explicit statement. So we have one for the first beast and one for the second beast. Plus, we have all of the biblical characteristics that we just talked about. So you can understand. The characteristics that identifies the sea beast in Revelation 13, along with the direct similarities of the little horn of Daniel 7, conclusively identify the beast as the papacy. That's the first beast. Number 666 only provides confirmatory evidence of this identification. So let me say this again. Remember, we had about 11 identifying marks. Now, those are the basic identifying marks. You don't even need the 666. Do you understand? So this is kind of a minor thing, except that if you start chipping away at it, pretty soon you have nothing. Do you get the point? That's why I think it's significant. So we're going to look at it. This is another one, 42 months. Some have said, and it says so in that CD set, that the 3.5 years is not 1,260 years, but what it is 3.5 is man's feeble attempt to reach God's number 7 again. But you can understand from the council we have, Great Controversy 349, that this period stated in the preceding chapters began, she says, with the papacy's getting into supremacy at 538 and terminating in 1798. And she says, at the time the Pope was made captive by the French army, the papal power received a deadly wound, and so on. Now, the name and the number of the beast, what do we know so far? The sea beast, that is the beast in Revelation 13 phase, represents the papacy. It has a parallel description to the little horn of Daniel 7. It has a blasphemous name, and in the Greek it's the names of blasphemy. And the second beast of Revelation 13 is the land beast. Does everybody understand this so far? I mean, this is just basic stuff that everybody should know. Likely you would. Now, here what I want to ask you about is gematria, the practice of representing names by numbers. And we're told three different references I have here. It was a method practiced among the ancients to denote names by numbers. The ancients are before the time of Christ, if you understand. This is another one from Adam Clark commentary. Representing numbers by letters of the alphabet gave rise to a practice among the ancients of representing names also by numbers. Examples of this kind abound in the writings of heathen, Jews, and Christians. Another one, this is from Thomas Newton in Dissertations on the Prophecies. It was a method practiced by the ancients to denote names by numbers, as the name Thoth or the Egyptian Mercury was signified by the number 1218. It hath been the usual method in all God's dispensations for the Holy Spirit to accommodate his expressions to the customs, fashions, and manners of the several ages. Since then, this art of mystery of numbers was so much used among the ancients, it is less wonderful or less curious that the beast also should have his number, and his number is 666. Now, I'm going to tell you a little anecdotal story that will help you to understand this also. I was taking a flight from Baltimore to Los Angeles, and because I believe very much in stewardship and faithfulness, I always look for the cheap tickets. I've never purchased a first-class ticket in 16 years at the General Conference. I'll promise you that. But I just want to tell you, it's kind of a chore sometimes when you're going overseas and you ride for 20 hours in the same seat with just, you know. Anyway, occasionally, because of how much I travel, I get bumped to first class. And this was one of those days. It happened in December of this last year. I was actually going out to give this presentation to the evangelists at the West Point of Evangelism. And they called my name, and I came up to the ticket office there where the agent was working. And they said, Mr. Reed, we need your seat in the back. We're putting you in first class. And I said, oh, do you have to? And anyway, I thanked them and took my seat up there. And they gave me a window seat. It's a 757, and there's 8 rows in first class, 4 across. So that's 32 seats in first class. Every one was taken, except the one beside me. Until just about time for the door to close, and a precious lady came running in with her briefcase all out of breath and sat down beside me and spoke to me in English in a German accent. It turns out that this lady was Dr. Claudia Rapp, who is a full professor of history at UCLA. She is from Germany. She was raised in Germany. And she told me that when she was growing up, after her sophomore year of high school, her parents enrolled her in a high school in Germany that every class was taught either in Latin or classical Greek. Now, it wasn't the class of Greek or the class of Latin. Whatever class you took was taught in the ancient languages. When she graduated from academy, she was accepted as a student at Cambridge University in England, where she graduated with honors, and also she got her PhD in Byzantine history, the time from the apostles to the 1500s. And so, obviously, I took the occasion to ask her, what about gematria? Have you ever heard of that? She looked at me and says, you're kidding, aren't you? And I said, no, I have a question about it. She said, it's very common. So she gave me her email address, and I sent her an email when I got to my destination. And she sent me an email back with a list of books in the UCLA library with all of the Gnostic writings of the Greek New Testament and the Old Testament where gematria was used. Do you understand that God put that woman beside me to help confirm what we know? Do you see what I'm saying? And by the way, she asked me, she was grading papers to begin with, and then when the little meal came, she said, enjoy your food to me. So I took that as an occasion to think, well, maybe she would talk to me, and we talked the whole rest of the way. At any rate, she told me that she was a Methodist, but she was going to the Presbyterian Church because they have a better choir, and she sings in the choir. And real interesting. But she said, tell me about your work. And I told her that I was, you know, I taught money management and so on, and I had written some books on prophecy. And when she sent me the email with the books in their library, and oh, by the way, I bought the book Gematria in the New Testament and the Gnostic Writings off the internet and have the book. But anyway, she said, you told me that you wrote a book on money management from a Christian perspective. I would sure like to buy one. And also something about prophecy. So I sent her complimentary copies of It's Your Money and Almost Home. And she wrote back and says, I feel they're a treasure. I will read them. Which is quite interesting. You never know what will happen in things like this. Well, let me just go on here quickly. Here's something very, very interesting. The new interpreters are saying that God never asked us to calculate anything in Revelation. That word, you know, count the number, you're just supposed to interpret the number, not do any counting. Some say John the Revelator is not asking us to do mathematical calculations with regard to 666 number. Is this correct? In fact, it is not correct. We are explicitly asked to compute or calculate the number. And I'm going to show you what that means. Revelation 13:18, he who has wisdom, let him count the number of the beast. That's where we're looking right now, and counting. The word count here is only used here in Revelation 13:18 and in Luke 14:28, where one is told in Luke 14 that before building a house, he should first sit down and count the cost. Now, in other words, any one of us knows if you take plans to a lumber yard, they can do a takeoff and tell you what the building materials cost you and so on. You're talking about labor and materials to build a house to see if he has enough money to do it. Now, it's also interesting, the word count is, do some of you have Strong's Concordance? You can get a Strong's Concordance. Well, number 5516 says where the meaning is to use pebbles to enumerate or to compute. In other words, you're supposed to count. And the real interesting thing also is a form of the word count is also used in Acts 19:19, where they counted or added up the value of the books on magic that were burned. This is Strong's 4860, which means to compute jointly or to reckon or compute. In other words, they counted up the value of the books. And you remember it was like 500 pieces of silver or something like that. Real interesting. In addition to that, the word for number in Revelation, in the Greek, Revelation 17 and 18, like the number of his name, the number of a man, and the number 666, all are the Greek word arithmos, which means to enumerate, to count, to compute, to reckon, or to figure out, or to calculate. And that is Strong's word 705 and 706. So you can look it up. It seems to me, I mean, obviously I have the background that I do, but most anybody can use a Strong's Concordance and look these words up. Do you understand? We are encouraged to count. So, here's understanding the number 666. The number alone cannot identify the beast, since numerous names can add up to 666. Somebody asked me what the G stood for in my name right before the meeting here, because it said G. Edward Reed up there. It's George. And George Edward Reed spells 666. That's why I just used the G. No, I'm actually kidding you. My name really is George, but I've never done it. But, you know, many names do add up to 666. But remember, for me to be the Antichrist, I would have to live for 1,260 years and persecute the saints. Do you understand? I mean, all other 11 things have to apply as well. The fact that any one of your names could compute to 666 is, listen carefully, totally immaterial. That's important for you to understand. Okay? The beast must first be identified by the other biblical clues, and then, of course, the 666 must fit with the beast. Otherwise, there could be no valid reason for the angel giving John the information contained in Revelation 13:18 at this point in the prophetic narrative. So this is a picture from Dr. Bakayoki's part one, the numeric interpretation of 666. And he's talking about all of these creatures or characters out through time have had 666 applied to them at one time or another. For example, Ronald Wilson Reagan. And this one is not using gematria, you know, like what is R and what is O and what is N and so on, but you just add six letters is six, and six letters is six, and six letters is six, which is all goofiness, as you can understand. But anyway, these are what you call straw men. Since this is foolish, so it would be foolish to do something else. You understand? That's what we call a straw man. Another one is Johannes Paulus II, John Paul II, is 666. So he's saying, since Reagan is goofy, so it would be goofy to apply it to the Pope. That's what they're saying, actually. Here's one that's real interesting. Adventist critics argue that even E.G. White's name adds up the number 666. It is true. Ellen Gould White. Now, the interesting part about it, the Bible says that it's a man's name. Isn't that incredible? So Ellen White's free right off the bat. But in addition, she didn't live for 1,260 years, and best I can tell, she didn't persecute the saints or try to change the law of God. Do you understand? Okay. Understanding the number 666, then, most commentators identify the beast of Revelation 13 as the sea beast of Revelation 13. Now, I'm going to tell you what I did. I actually took the entire chapter of Revelation, and it has 18 verses, and I wrote it out longhand on notebook paper. And then I did something very interesting. I tried to find out every pronoun, like he, what was the antecedent? Do you understand? What does he? Who is the real thing it points to? Very interesting. And insert the logical noun as the antecedent of each pronoun. It is easy to see that the beast whose number is 666 is the first or the sea beast of Revelation 13 when you do that. You can do it very easily. You can just write it down and do that. Now, here's something interesting also, very interesting. All of the activities of the earth beast are in support of or related to the sea beast. In other words, everything the U.S. does, it's not anything about itself because it's always helping the papacy. Do you understand? That's what we see there. Thus, this number 666 has to do in some way with the identity of the medieval papacy. Once we know who the sea beast is, then we're a long way toward understanding the number of his name or the 666. We can also eliminate all of the names that are not related to the papacy. All the other biblical characteristics of the Antichrist must be considered and met as well for the 666 to fit the proper beast. Now, the preterist calculation, which attributes 666 to Nero, is nothing more than a rather desperate attempt to find some likely candidate for the Antichrist other than the papacy. Do you understand? That's the whole point. So, here's something that you may not have known. The Douay version of the Bible is the official Catholic version of the Bible. It was translated from the Latin, Jerome's Vulgate. You understand the Douay version? Here's what the Douay version says of Revelation 13:18. Here is wisdom. Let he that hath understanding, let him count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and the number of him is 666. Now that's the Douay version. But every Douay version I've ever seen has a footnote. And at the bottom of the page, in the footnote on Revelation 13:18 reads as follows. 666, the numeral letters of his name shall make up this number. Isn't that incredible? This is right in the Douay version of the Bible. Now here's another one, the New English Bible. The New English Bible was finished in 1970. It required 24 years to complete and enlisted the labors of 50 recognized biblical scholars, and it is based on the original Greek and Hebrew text. In Revelation 13:18 in the New English Bible, here is the key, and anyone who has intelligence may work out the number of the beast. The number represents a man's name, and the numerical value of its letters is 666. Isn't that incredible? I mean, there's just so much additional information. And the NIV, this calls for wisdom. If anyone has insight, let him calculate the number of the beast, for it is a man's number, and his number is 666. Just some interesting things. The idea of associating 666 with the Antichrist is not a new phenomenon, but since the early days of Christianity, there has been much discussion as to the significance of 666. One of the earliest to write on the subject was Irenaeus. Remember I told you the Antonicene Fathers, the books that were written by the leaders of the church after the disciples? They also believed that the numerical value of the letters would form the name. So I'm going to show you this. Here's what Irenaeus said. And remember that I just showed you in the last slide, he lived from 130 AD to 202 AD, so he's a pretty old guy. Although certain as to the number of the name of Antichrist, 666, we should not come to a rash conclusion, because he's way back there as to the name itself, because this number is capable of being fitted to many names. Such then being the state of the case, and this number being found in all of the most approved and ancient copies of the Apocalypse, and of those men who saw John face to face bearing their testimony to it, while reason also leads us to conclude that the number of the name of the beast, if reckoned according to the Greek mode of calculation by the value of letters contained, it will amount to 666. Now this is incredible, because way back there the early church fathers knew that if you figured it out who it was, his name would be 666. But quite interesting. Characteristics of the beast name. It's a blasphemous name associated with the papacy, a name that is a number associated with it. The name is a man's name or title, and the number of the name is 666. So look at this now. The name has a number associated with it. It's the number of a man. The number is 666, or 666, not 666. I have found no Greek text or Bible translation that calls the number 666 or 666. It is always spelled out as 666 or 666 or just the number 666. Strong's Concordance, number 5516, it says it denotes respectively 660 and 6, 666 as a numeral. Now, it's also very interesting that some people say that 6 is man's feeble attempt to get to God's number 7. You remember I just showed you that. Some individuals talk about it that way. It is true that that 7 indicates completeness and so on. However, there is no evidence in the Bible that 6 is a bad number. Now, this is important, even though it may appear so from Babylonian culture. If you look up 6 in the Bible, here's what you're going to find out. For example, on the sixth day of creation, when God had completed his work, including the crowning act of creating man in his own image, he said everything was very good. There were 6 cities of refuge in the promised land, which I gather was a good thing. 3 on each side of the Jordan River, as you may remember. There were 6 steps to Solomon's throne. And as smart as he was, he wouldn't have made it that way if it wasn't a good number. Another one is that the highest order of angels, the seraphim, each have 6 wings. Oops, God made a big mistake, right? No, 6 is not a bad number. Under God's orders, 6 lambs were slain on special days. This is Ezekiel 46, verses 4 and 6. And I have all the Bible references for those other ones there. I know I'm going too fast, but I will just tell you, someday this might be available where you could get a copy of it or something. Some are now suggesting that the 66 is a human number. However, the pronouns used, that is how to in the Greek, that's the English transliteration, are genitive masculine singular, his name, his number, etc., and refer back to the first beast as their antecedent, not to humanity and not mankind. Now, a man's name or title. This is very interesting. Remember that no person could ever live 1,260 years this side of the flood. Isn't that true? So it really is not a man's name like George Edward Reed or whatever your name is, but it is a title of a man for it to be able to last that long. And we can see that from the Bible also. The Greek word for name in this area, Revelation 13, 17, the name of the beast or the number of his name is onoma, which is, this is the same Greek word that's used in Revelation 19, 16. And there it says, and he has on his robe and on his thigh a name written, and it is King of Kings and Lord of Lords, which is a title and not a name. It's not Jesus Christ, Son of God. Do you understand? It is King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Here it is clearly used as a title, not a specific name like Jesus Christ. The Greek word onoma is Strong's 3686, which has the connotation of authority or character, or again, a title. Now, we're going to look at, it could not be a specific man's name because, of course, it would have to apply to the papacy, which has the 1,260-year period. So the name also is a blasphemous name or a title which could be more easily given to a person than a name, of course. Now, there's another question. At the end of Dr. Bakayoki's presentations and at the end of the slide presentation, he says, one of the reasons that we don't want to apply vicarius filii Dei to the Pope or to the papacy is because we don't know which language to use. And vicarius filii Dei is written in Latin. But Latin was the language of Rome. Pilate had a sign inscribed that was fastened to the cross of Jesus Christ, which stated, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews, and it was written in Hebrew, Greek, and Latin. These are Luke 23 and John 19. Latin is also the official language of the Roman Catholic Church. Latin is the language of the Roman Catholic adopted Bible, the Vulgate. Latin was used for centuries in the Roman Catholic Mass. Luther wrote his 95 Theses in Latin, not his native German, because Latin was the official language of the Roman Catholic Church and could be read and understood by the clergy. Do you understand? I mean, this is why we're talking about Latin here. Still today, all official documents, like the one I showed you yesterday from the current Pope, all official documents of the Roman Catholic Church appear first in Latin and then are translated into English and other languages. The Roman Catholic Church, not Protestants, chose vicarius filii Dei, a Latin term to represent the Pope. Now, this is, you know, evangelists have used this for a long time. The papacy is titled Vicarius Filii Dei, but we're going to now see something interesting. Indeed, it does add up to 666, standard Adventist interpretation. By the way, I should not say standard Adventist interpretation. This is the standard Reform explanation, the Protestant Reformers. You understand that. Okay. I'm going to spare you some of these other details because there's some real interesting stuff coming up here. People started way back in the 1500s using the numerical value of vicarius filii Dei and so on. Now, here's what I want to show you, however. Some people say vicarius filii Dei is not an official title of the Pope. Let me just tell you something from the standpoint of law. If you go into court, the more evidence you need to prove your case, the weaker your case is. Do you understand? In other words, if I have to give you 100 reasons why this happened, it's weaker than if I can just give you 3 good ones or come up with one eyewitness. You understand? This is the kind of thing. So what I'm going to tell you is I'm going to show you that there are 10 official documents of the Roman Catholic Church that repeatedly use vicarius filii Dei as a title for the Pope, including the very last one down here, John Paul II himself in Crossing the Threshold of Hope. So we're going to go through this really quickly. I'm not going to read all the stuff. I'm just going to tell you there are 10. There are even more, but the more you get, the weaker the case. You understand? So we've got 10 good ones here. The donation of Constantine is one of those. And by the way, that's been around since the 8th century. So for at least 1,200 years, the Roman Catholic Church itself has used vicarius filii Dei as the name for the Pope. I'm not going to go into this really much more detail because I want you to see the second one. And this is the Decretium of Gratian. He was the founder of the Roman Catholic canon law. 1159 is when he died. Produced the first compilation of Catholic laws. In it, he calls the Pope vicarius filii Dei. There's much more I could show you. This is an actual photocopy of the document, and here's where the vicarius filii Dei is in it. This, by the way, was a courtesy of Dr. Bakayoki. Corpus Juris Canonici is also the official laws of the Roman Catholic Church, and that's been Vicaris Filii Dei in there for years and years. The Roman Catholic Encyclopedia, Propter Biblia, is also Bibliothea, and it also has the imprimatur of the Vatican and the Pope right there on it. So this is interesting. Vicaris Filii Dei is in this. Official papal documents for years and years. There's many of those. Various popes have used it. Writings of Cardinal Henry Manning, many of them speaking frequently of the Pope as Vicaris Filii Dei. And these are ones now that are going to be down to modern times that are very, very interesting. One of them is our Sunday Visitor, the paper that I subscribe to, November 15, 1914. Of course, that was before I started subscribing, but it had a real interesting thing in it. There's always, back in those days, there was also always on about page 3, a Bureau of Information. It's like question and answer or letters to the editor where they write in and they would answer it. And somebody wrote in, is it true that the words of the Apocalypse in the 13th chapter, 18th verse refer to the Pope? And the answer given was, the words referred to are these. Here is wisdom, let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and the number of him is 666. The title of the Pope in Rome is Vicarius Filii Dei. This is inscribed on his mitre. Now, I want you to understand that we're talking about right here, the mitre. Where have I? I'm going to try to. Right here. See that right there? And if you take the letters of this title, which represent Latin numerals printed large, and add them together, they come to 666. And then they printed it out just like this. So add those all together, and it comes to 666. But then it says, we submitted this argument to the Reverend Ernest R. Hull, and he answered the following manner. Almost every eminent man in Christendom who has enjoyed the privilege of possessing enemies has had his name turned and twisted until they could get the number 666 out of it. In past history, there have been numberless beasts or antichrists, all of whose names counted up to 666. I fancy that my own name, especially in Latin form, might give the number of the beast. And then he, believe it or not, did it. Then his name does come up to 666. But what we really have in this statement, though, and this is the underlined part down here, is an explicit admission that the title of the Pope in Rome is Vicarius Filii Dei, and the letters do add up to 666. The fact that Hull's name also adds up to 666 is totally immaterial. Does everybody understand? So he's trying to say, since mine does and so many other people do, it really doesn't make any difference. Then there was another one, April 18, 1915. The question was, what are the letters supposed to be on the Pope's crown and what do they signify, if anything? And the letters inscribed on the Pope's mitre, again, are these, Vicaris Filii Dei, which is Latin for Vicar of the Son of God. Catholics hold that the Church, which is a visible society, must have a visible head. Christ, before his ascension to heaven, appointed St. Peter to act as his representative. And upon the death of Peter, the man who succeeded him to the office of Bishop of Rome was recognized as the head of the Church. Hence, to the Bishop of Rome, as the head of the Church, was given the title Vicar of Christ. Now, the answer goes on to say, enemies of the papacy denounced this title as a malicious assumption. But the Bible informs us that Christ did not only give his church authority to teach, but also to rule. And laying claim to the authority to rule as Christ's spiritual kingdom in Christ's stead is not a whit more malicious than laying claim to the authority to teach in Christ's name. And this every minister does. Well, the answer goes on. The letters inscribed on the Pope's mitre are these, Vicarius Filii Dei. I'm only telling you that because it's very interesting that he says the enemies of the papacy denounce this title, and I'm hoping that you understand that these are important things to understand. Okay, I'm going to give you a summary statement here. This statement has several very significant admissions, this one from the 18th, on the part of the Catholic editor, the Reverend John F. Noel. He uses the terms Vicaris Filii Dei and Vicar of Christ interchangeably. Accordingly, both are official, not just Vicar of Christ, as they say. In addition, he states that the Bishop of Rome succeeded St. Peter as Bishop of Rome, and since the Church has claimed for centuries that the donation of Constantine, that Peter was Vicaris Filii Dei, those who succeeded Peter will also be Vicaris Filii Dei. If I am the king and you succeed me, then you are the king. Do you understand? That's just my summary here. Okay, now here's a real interesting situation. A number of years ago, when one of our evangelists was talking in a public meeting, he said that Vicaris Filii Dei was on the Pope's tiara, you know, the golden crown thing. And The Roman Catholic Church wrote to the General Conference and they said, you should stop doing this because it is not on the tiara. And until you can prove that it's on the tiara, you know, you better stop doing it. So the brethren all huddled together and said, wow, we're in big trouble here. So it just happened that they decided to do a proper research. Remember what I told you? When you do what kind of a search? A thorough search, what kind of things you can find. Robert Correa was a Brazilian theology student. He became very passionate in his search for the use of the papal title Vicarius Filii Dei. His dedication paid off as he was able to obtain valuable information. By the way, as you can see, this is a slide that Dr. Bakayoki provided in his CD. To facilitate his research on the Pope's title Vicarius Filii Dei, Robert Correa moved from La Sierra, California to CUC, that is Columbia Union College area. He wanted to be in touch with the General Conference and use the Library of Congress. The GC granted him permission to assist the committee in its search for the Pope's title. When Robert Correa learned that the primary source was an article in our Sunday Visit, the one I just showed you, April 18, 1915, he decided to drive with a friend to the publishing house in Huntington, Indiana. Now, you understand, this is pretty serious when you actually take an old car in these times and drive all the way to Indiana from Washington, D.C. But Correa returned triumphantly to the GC, delivering to the special committee the only duplicate original copy of our Sunday Visitor. The brethren could hardly believe it, because there it was, what I just showed you. Vicarius Filii Dei is the official title of the Pope, and it's on his mitre, and so on. In the light of the Correa's success in obtaining rare copies of our Sunday Visitor, the GC Special Committee made up a packet of documents for him to take down to Catholic University of America for evaluation. So the question that we want to ask is, have the Our Sunday Visitor 1914-1915 statements been refuted? This is Vicarius Filii Dei, over here, VFD, been refuted or retracted? The answer is no. They also talked about September 16, 1917 and August 3, 1941. And I'll show you those real quickly. Our Sunday Visitor in 1917, now this is, by the way, Dr. Bakayoki's statement, in 1917 and again in 1941, twice recanted their admission that Vicarius Filii Dei is the title of the Pope inscribed on his mitre. This is not the case. I'm going to show you in just a moment why not. This is his statement again. The August 3, 1941 issue of our Sunday Visitor categorically affirms, as a matter of fact, the tiara of the Pope bears no inscription whatsoever. Now, I want you to understand something interesting. These denials are talking about the tiara, and the claims before were that it was on the mitre. Do you understand? The mitre is the pointed cloth hat that, you know, you frequently see. And, of course, the tiara is the real heavy one that is typically only worn on the day that the Pope is crowned the Pope. So the denial is not that what they had said earlier, that it isn't on the mitre, but they said that it is. And they also did, well, I'll just go, I think I have it in here. The claim that, this is again Dr. Bakayoki's work, the claim that the Pope's tiara bears no inscription whatsoever is discredited by the 1871 Belgian tiara and of the 1903 golden tiara, because both of these have inscriptions on them, Blessed Peter, Vicar of Christ, Governor of Earth, Father of Princes and Kings, and so on. So, I mean, they have had writing on them. Chief Shepherd of the whole fold of King Christ, incapable of erring as teacher of the faith and piety, supreme priest on earth by divine right, etc. Those kinds of things. Now, what is the application of the number 666 to Pope Benedict? This is the 1917 one. None whatsoever. Such an interpretation of chapter 13 and verse 18 of the Apocalypse is entirely unfounded. Now, I want you to listen to this and then listen to my explanation. It's unfounded and is nothing more than a display of malignant hatred and is the effervescence of a vacuous mind, empty mind. During the period of the Reformation and for many years after, the Apocalypse furnished the basis for much political and religious incrimination. In later years, really reliable commentaries have ceased the silly prattle about the popes, Napoleon, and Rome, and subjecting the Book of the Rules of Exegesis, see a reference to conditions existing at the time of John. Such interpreters have never shown that the title Vicarius Filii Dei is really inscribed on the Pope's tiara. Moreover, the passage states that the number refers to a man. In other words, the numerals represented by the letters of his name, which total 666. The words Vicarius Filii Dei are not the name of the Pope, and they do not even constitute his official title. Now, this is kind of interesting, because here's my explanation. In law school, I was told, if the facts are on your side, hammer on the facts. If the law is on your side, hammer on the law. If neither is on your side, hammer on your opponent. You get the point? And that's why you criticize the LAPD department. You understand, in the O.J. Simpson case. I mean, he was almost taken off the picture. This is exactly what the author is doing. He says that the views that don't agree with him are malignant, hatred, and come from vacuous or empty minds. He says that the Reformation interpretation is now passé. He says that no one has ever shown that vicus filii is on the tiara. Note that both the prior Our Sunday Visitor statement say that vicus filii is on the mitre, and they've never denied that. The tiara, by the way, the tiara mitre flap is just a straw man and is therefore immaterial. Do you understand what I'm saying by that? You have 10 major documents, starting with the donation of Constantine, that use it as an official title. Whether or not it's on his hat is totally immaterial. So that is what we call a straw man. You understand? You build the straw man up, and then you knock him down. That's just supposed to end the case. But it doesn't end the case because it doesn't do away with the 10 references that I just showed you before. So we're going to go on here. I'll just mention... Then he says that the vicus filii is not an official title of the Pope, but does not say it is not a title at all. This is not a contradiction or retraction of any earlier statement. The title is admittedly applied to the Pope and is therefore sufficient for the purposes of prophetic interpretation. Our Sunday Visitor, this is an interesting one, August 3, 1941. A pamphlet has come to me, this is someone writing in now, entitled The Mark of the Beast. I wonder where they got that. It identifies the Pope with this mark referred to in Revelation 13, 17, and 18. The answer is, it's too bad that the Seventh-day Adventists, who are so sensitive to criticism themselves, should circulate a pamphlet so antagonistic to the Catholic Church. The question you ask has been answered many times, although not in recent years in this paper. If we have recourse to the best biblical scholars or exegetes, we find them applying the text from Revelations to Nero, the arch persecutor of Christianity in the first century. To give color to their accusation, enemies of the church publicized something that is not true at all, namely that the Pope's tiara is inscribed with the words Vicarius Filii Dei. You see, they're standing up a straw man again so they can knock him down. If letters in that title were translated in Roman numerals, the sum would equal 666. As a matter of fact, the tiara of the Pope bears no inscription whatsoever. Well, I just showed you three different tiaras with inscriptions on them, but it's very strange, they say, that people can regard themselves as religious and still engage in an apostolate of, well, I can't even say that word. Somebody can say that here? That's right. And slander. Okay. Here's the summary of that statement. The denial of this article is that Vicarius Filii Dei is not inscribed on the Pope's tiara. This does not contradict the earlier statements in 1914 and 1915 statements, because they claim Vicarius Filii Dei is on the mitre and is the Pope's title. The next statement, that the tiara bears no inscription at all, would only be true if a specific tiara, since over time there have been likely dozens of tiaras, many of them which did indeed have inscriptions, as we have noted. Note that the author does not deny that Vicarius Filii Dei is a title of the Pope. Now, here's something very interesting. I actually enjoy finding stuff. I enjoy doing research more than I enjoy writing. Writing is very difficult for most people, including me. But I will just tell you that on March 5, 1943, Robert Correa, the young Brazilian theology student that I showed you his picture earlier, and Benjamin Mondica were sent by the General Conference of Seventh-day Adventists to the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C. to research Vicarius Filii Dei as a papal title. On that day, they interviewed Professor Johannes Quasten, the world's leading authority on patristic literature, that is, writings of the major Catholic Church leaders. Dr. Quasten is the author of a four-volume reference on that topic. In other words, he is the eminent man in the Catholic Church who knew about that such thing. Robert Correa asked Dr. Quasten, "Do you, as a recognized Catholic authority, accept the title Vicarius Filii Dei as a proper and legitimate title of the Holy Father?" Dr. Quasten responded, "The Pope has many titles. Although Vicarius Filii Dei is not as common, it is, however, an ancient title and should be accepted by any good Catholic scholar." As a matter of fact, this is very unusual, but when asked to put his response in writing, Dr. Quaston took a sheet of Catholic University stationery and wrote out the following. The title Vicaris Filii Dei, is, as well as the title Vicaris Christi, is a very common title for the Pope, and signed his name. And Robert Correa and his friend Benjamin Mondica authenticated before a notary the handwritten statement they received from Professor Quaston. They wanted to ensure that nobody would ever dispute the credibility of their story. Quaston's statement should silence Catholic critics who negate the use of Vicaris Filii Dei as a papal title. And so I'm going to show you, this is the actual document that's in the archives at the GC on Catholic University stationery. The title Vicaris Filii Dei, as well as the title Vicaris Christi, is very common as a title for the Pope, signed by the greatest of the Catholic historians at the time. Quite interesting. Now I'm going to show you one also that's very interesting. Have you ever taken like the SAT or some test you really hated and they wanted you to match stuff and do things that were really difficult and it's kind of, you know, mind-bending stuff? Well, look at this one. John Paul II, the late John Paul, he wrote a book called Crossing the Threshold of Hope. That was the title. In the first chapter, the title is The Pope. Now, the emphasis, the underlining I put here is mine. He didn't do any underlining. The leader of the Catholic Church is defined by the faith as the vicar of Jesus Christ and is accepted as such by believers. The Pope is considered the man on earth who represents the Son of God, who takes the place of the second person of the omnipotent God of the Trinity. This is on page 3. The Pope is not only the one who holds this title with regard to the Church entrusted to him, each bishop is Vicarius Christi also. Now, notice this. There are four titles of the Pope given. Vicar of Jesus Christ, representing the Son of God, of course, Filii Dei, takes the place of the second person, and then Vicarius Christi, or Christ. Now, I want you to understand something interesting. All of the letters, all of the adjectives that describe this part, all of these words are interchangeable. Vicar of means representing thee, or represents thee, or takes the place of, or vicarious. Do you understand? Those all mean the same thing. So do these things. Jesus Christ is the Son of God, is the second person of the Godhead, and is Christ. Do you see what I'm saying there? So look at this now. Very interesting. All the first column entries are equal or mean the same thing. All the names of the second column are equal or mean the same thing. Accordingly, any first column can fit with any second column name. So you could have Vicar of Christ, or Vicaris Filii Dei. Do you understand? It's very common. They all mean the same thing. The name Vicar, we're just about done here, and I'm going to let you have some questions, but there's a few more points I want to make. The name Vicaris Filii Dei is not a construct of Protestants or critics of the Roman Catholic Church. Please understand that. This Latin name means Vicar of the Son of God and has been used as one of the Pope's titles for over 1,200 years. The numerical value of the component letters of this title totals 666. This interpretation is based on the identification of the Pope as the Antichrist, that is, the first beast of Revelation 13 and the little horn of Daniel 7, the historic Reformation position. And inasmuch as we have identified the beast as the papacy, we must accept this view, the one I've just presented, as the best presented thus far. At the same time, we must recognize that there may be more implied in the cryptogram than this interpretation provides, but it is certainly a much better interpretation than 666, which has no context or relationship whatever. Do you understand? That's my summary statement about this. Now, I know that I've said a lot, and I hope I don't get myself in trouble or anything. I know I can defend my position here with the research that I have done. But some of you may have questions or comments, and I'll be happy to take a few, maybe just a 5 minutes worth, and we'll take a break. I know it's gotten kind of hot in here. Yeah, I'm getting the signal. We only have 5 minutes on the tape at the back. Yes, please.
It sounds like this, what was the fellow's name that did this?
Robert Correa?
Well, no, the one who bought the DVD.
Oh, Dr. Bacciocchi?
It sounded like he was trying to, his conclusion was that the 666 said it wasn't supportable, but
yes.
The evidence he presented in the DVD, it sounds like he...
That's the whole point. As a matter of fact, this gentleman is saying something very interesting. Dr. Bacciocchi actually made a case contrary to his conclusions. Do you understand what I'm saying? In other words, the list of 10 things, any of us can get right off the internet. But the fact is, the slides that I was showing you of Robert Curry and all those people, they were his slides. It's really amazing. So this is a good point. But he was wanting to come down on the position that has nothing to do with the papacy or the United States.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries have been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.